right now on The Daily Debrief. R&B singer R. Kelly appears in court in jailhouse clothes.
They don't argue that he's an increased flight risk. They don't argue that he's an increased danger.
Does the state's request to increase his bail really even matter? Also,
and then when I came back, she wasn't there.
The witness who places this 9-year-old Florida victim with her alleged killer right before she vanished. Does the witness have reason to lie? And
he used a corn rake because he tried to make it look like a farm accident.
Did a wife's affair lead to cold-blooded murder? The defense and the prosecution agree.
She was murdered.
But who did it? The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Tuesday, September 17th.
Welcome to The Debrief, everyone. A loss today for Illinois prosecutors accusing R&B singer R. Kelly of sex crimes. Kelly appeared in court wearing orange prison clothing as a state court judge denied a prosecution request to raise Kelly's Illinois bond amount. The judge said the request was more or less pointless since Kelly is in federal custody right now on federal charges. The federal government says it will not let him go even as charges rack up in various state courts.
The mere fact that someone may have been charged with other cases in other jurisdiction is not a basis to increase bond. It's not a basis under the statute. It's not a basis under the case law. They don't argue that he's an increased flight risk. They don't argue that he's an increased danger. They don't argue any reason in their motion why bond should be increased. Should the federal court modify those orders, I fully expect that he will be put on some kind of house arrest, electronic monitoring, GPS, or something like that, which also means that he's not a flight risk. He doesn't have a passport. He's not a danger to others.
I would just say that a lot of what counsel just said is based on speculation about what could happen if his bond were changed in one of the other courts. And so that's a lot of speculation. I would also point out that part of his charges here in the Northern District of Illinois include the fact that the defendant is accused of having influence the witnesses on that case, that first trial. And lastly, I would say that the defendant does have additional charges, and that absolutely is appropriate to bring before this court to ask that his bond be increased. He does have additional charges.
All right, look, as a practical matter, he's being held now, no bail, in the Eastern District of New York and in the Northern District of Illinois. Unless Mr. Greenberg can convince both of those courts that he should be released on bond, Mr. Kelly's going to remain in custody. So as far as a motion to increase the bond, I don't believe it's appropriate at this particular point in time.
The woman who posted R. Kelly's $100,000 bond now wants her money back. Her attorney told the judge she didn't know he was going to be indicted on more charges. The judge was not pleased with this request.
There's a certain risk that a surety has in signing a bond slip for someone, on behalf of someone who's in custody. She took that risk.
Judge, notwithstanding the language on that, we still ask that in the issue of fairness, Judge, Mr. Kelly is a man of massive resources. This is a private citizen that comes for a limited purpose to assist. She didn't know that New York was going to indict. She didn't know that Minnesota was going to indict. She didn't know that Northern District of Illinois was going to indict. What we actually say in the interest of fairness, if he's not going to be released on bond in this instance, exonerate the bond. And it's not an uncommon practice.
And the money is posted on behalf of the defendant by the surety. I'm going to deny your motion. I'm going to deny it. I don't believe that there's any basis for it, so it'll be denied.
R. Kelly has a hearing scheduled tomorrow for federal court in Illinois. He also has a court hearing in October in the Eastern District of New York and in December back in Cook County, Illinois on state charges. So now to our guests. Roger P. Foley is with us from California. Eklund Mercy is in Georgia. So Eklund, did the judge make the right call here in Illinois?
Yeah. Yes, he did. With regards to the bond, that was like a moot argument. He's not going anywhere, so increasing the bond, there was no changing in circumstances, so increasing the bond made no sense. With regards to the bond, not giving this lady her money back, that was interesting as hell. Like, that was interesting, but we already knew that. I've actually tried that, and I failed many a times. I think the judge made the right decision.
So, Roger, at one point, the defense basically said, look, R. Kelly's victims were having buyer's remorse. Steve Greenberg said that on this program. Is the woman who posted bond now having buyer's remorse?
It sounds like it, but I'll be honest, I was surprised that the judge, I mean, I don't know that she would get her money back. I mean, she pays a premium to a bondsman. Does she get the money back? No, but she's not allocated to it, meaning that if he was to get out and flee, that, you know, her house wouldn't be in jeopardy or something to that effect, whatever collateral she gave. So I was surprised by that. I mean, it was very easy for the judge to say, okay, we'll terminate that bond. I'm surprised that he didn't.
Okay, we're going to move along now. Opening statements in the trial of an Iowa man accused of murdering his wife with a corn rake. Prosecutors say Todd Mullis plotted the crime after his wife had an affair. The motive, the state says, was the family farm. If wife Amy Mullis left Todd, she would keep a stake in the property. The defendant first said his wife died accidentally after falling on the corn rake, but the medical examiner found six holes in her back. Corn rakes have only four prongs. Now the defendant is saying someone else killed his wife. Some of the puncture wounds were at an upward angle, others at a downward angle. Linda Kenny Bodden in studio here with me. You are a former prosecutor turned defense attorney. Listen to how the state kicked off this case.
Amy's last moments on this earth, she would feel the corn rake that she was stabbed with in her back. She would feel that rake pierce her body. She would collapse to the ground. Her lungs would fill with blood and air. And she would take those last breaths while she lay on a floor in a shed on her farm. Amy was not happy. She was having an affair, and she was planning on leaving the defendant. The defendant knew something was going on. Amy had previously had an affair, and they had reconciled. But in July 2018, the defendant knew she was having another affair. He wasn't going to let Amy get away with cheating on him again. And more importantly, he wasn't going to let Amy take half of his farm. The defendant made sure the only people at his farm that day were him, his wife, and his kids, because he didn't want any other witnesses. He had gotten Amy outside to help do chores on the farm, and then he had to separate her so he could execute his plan.
Linda Kenny Bodden, you were listening to that along with me. Are you buying what the state's trying to sell to the jury?
I actually buy it completely. I mean, I differed with all my guests today, Aaron Keller, and you know that I do defense pretty strongly here. I mean, I think he had motive, means, opportunity. She had the affairs. There were searches on his computers. I absolutely think the state is going to meet their burden.
Okay, that's your opinion. Eklund Mercy is in Atlanta, Georgia, with me. Let me direct the defense opening statement towards you here. Big questions as to whether or not this really was an accident. Listen to this, Eklund, and give me your thoughts.
At some point, Todd noticed, Tristan noticed, that Amy seemed to maybe lose her balance, comment upon her dizziness. His comment was, honey, take it easy. Why don't you go back in the house? Don't push yourself. She wanted to help. So she continued on, and there was again observation of her unsteadiness. So finally she agreed that she would stop what she was doing. Tristan goes to the shed where an awful, awful thing had occurred. Tristan yells for his father. He comes, he finds her in the shed, horribly, with his corn fork stuck in her back. Todd did state he thought he had no other explanation. She went in the barn, she ends up with a fork in her back. She must have fell. He had no idea. So Todd couldn't see the wounds. There was some blood, and that was about it. It was wrong. She was murdered.
Okay, Eklund Mercy, what do you make of that? An accident that the defense is now saying is a murder, just this defendant didn't do it?
Yeah, I think that's what they're trying to sell. And, I mean, I think they can. You know, the other people have motives, means, and opportunity. She was cheating with two other gentlemen, so Somebody could have potentially wanted her dead. And then because this was her husband, he wants to know who killed his wife. So I think the defense can really, really harp on that as well.
This case turned into a soap opera right from the start, with relatives testifying for the state that the defendant and his wife were indeed having a troubled marriage.
When my wife and I approached Amy, she said that she was
planning on getting a divorce, and she was going to leave Todd, and that he was going to flip out. At that time, she said it'd be a little bit later after the crops were out of the field.
Did she indicate to you that she was going to divorce Todd or just leave him?
She was going to divorce him. Amy asked me if she could store Grandma's couch and some chairs and lamps at my house so that she would have some furniture when she left Todd. I stored it. I still have it in my garage. I had set it on some pallets and covered it with some tarps to keep the animals off of it.
And why did you keep that furniture?
So she would have furniture to when she moved out, so she would have something to start.
Were you aware several years ago, about 5 years ago, that Amy had an affair?
I was.
And how did you find out about that affair?
I found out through Amy. We didn't see them a whole lot. They seemed to be working things out.
Do you remember a time when you had a conversation with the defendant?
I do.
Approximately how long after that affair was this conversation?
I'm going to say right around two and a half years after. I said to him, it looks like you're working things out. He said, well, I have to. He said, I'm not going to lose my farm and what I've worked for.
At some point, did you have a conversation with Todd about him suspecting that Amy was having another affair?
Yes. Okay. He had confronted the field manager. He said that via her phone, he could tell that, you know, she was contacting him. They were contacting each other.
The defendant and his wife were doing chores at home when this accident or murder happened. Their son was next on the witness stand to describe what happened.
My mom, she said she was getting dizzy, and she said that she was bleeding because she had had a surgery a few days prior. We asked her what was wrong, and she said it was nothing.
Did your dad say anything to your mom or tell her to do something?
Yes.
What did he say?
He said, if you want to help out, it would mean a lot to us if you would go get the pet cage that was in a barn.
What did you see when you walked in?
My mom. She was kind of on her hands and knees, face down. I yelled for my dad.
Did you see anything that was protruding or sticking out of your mom's body?
Yes.
What did you see?
A corn rake.
And where was that at in relation to your mom's body?
In her center back, probably, somewhere around there.
What did you do?
I checked for a pulse on her neck and her arm, and I put my finger, or my index and my middle finger, under her nose to see if she was, you know, if there was breath.
That mother later died at the hospital. Also watching these cases with us here, of course, are Roger Foley, Bob Hillis. So, Bob, what do you make of the son's testimony here? He said no one else was at the farm. Does that destroy the defense theory that someone else did this?
Well, it places it in the lap of both the son, really, and the father. I mean, there were two other children there, but they didn't seem to be in the vicinity when the crime happened.
And Roger, I was also going to ask you about this here, too. The testimony about the affairs and everything, does the state have a clear motive here?
Well, there's a clear motive, but whether or not they can tie it in just because he said something years before or there's research on a computer doesn't mean he did it. People may think about killing their husbands or wives. It doesn't mean that they do it, right? It's the actual act that's illegal, not the thought of it.
And Bob, we're looking at the corn rake right there. I mean, talk about a heck of a alleged murder weapon here. It looks brutal.
Well, it is. It's a brutal way to be killed. And also the evidence with respect to the number of puncture wounds and the number of tines on the fork are inconsistent, which suggests, again, it wasn't an accident. It was an intentional act.
A lot to mull over in this case as we move forward through testimony into another day. And still ahead here on The Debrief, an Ohio attorney defends his client's decision to snap selfies after giving birth to a child she was later accused of murdering. Plus, cross-examination of the state's key witness against a man accused of killing a 9-year-old Florida girl. Those cases and more when we return. New reaction to the case of the Ohio teen acquitted of murdering her baby 2 days after her high school prom. Skylar Richardson broke down in tears after the jury acquitted her of most charges but convicted her of abusing the infant's corpse. Defense attorney Charles M. Rickers told us today that selfies, which the state said showed Richardson happy after giving birth, were actually part of her tactic to keep her mother and her boyfriend from learning she was ever pregnant.
We don't know what would have happened had Skylar made different choices in terms of prenatal care. What we do know is that on April 26th, the first time she saw her obstetrician, she was told that she would deliver a baby within 10 weeks, and she delivered 11 days later. And frankly, it's something that Skylar blames herself for, the fact that she did not get prenatal care, and the fact that she had a stillborn is something that she will live with the rest of her life. I know from a number of focus groups, from this jury and other people that I've spoken with, that those people who watched the entirety of the trial and saw all the evidence, they know that Skylar did not kill a child. I know in my heart of hearts she didn't either.
Closing arguments expected tomorrow in the case of a South Carolina man charged in the disappearance of his girlfriend. Sidney Moorer was married when he began a side relationship with Heather Elvis. Elvis has been missing for almost 6 years. Sidney Moorer's wife, Tammy, was convicted in a separate trial last fall of kidnapping Elvis. Testimony was on hold today due to other scheduling commitments. And now to the death penalty trial of a Florida man accused of killing a 9-year-old girl. Felicia Williams disappeared in 2014, and her naked body later turned up on a causeway in Old Tampa Bay. Defendant Granville Ritchie, who goes by Trevor, is accused of sexually assaulting the girl, beating her, and strangling her to death. Prosecutors say he put the girl's body in a suitcase in order to move it. The state's key witness in this case is Ebony Wiley, a woman who places the victim with the defendant when the victim disappeared. At first, Wiley said the victim went to get candy and didn't return. She later said that was a lie the defendant asked her to tell police. Here was her final story.
I told them that I lied, and they was like, "What you lied about?" I said I left her with Trevor, and he wanted me to go and get some weed for him. And then when I came back, she wasn't there.
Did you tell them that you had gone to the CVS looking for her?
I'm not sure. I told them all that. I don't even think they gave me a chance to tell them all that. They just arrested me. They said, "You're arrested for giving false information."
And was this third time, this third story that you told them, was that then the truth of what happened?
Yes.
Everything that you have testified to here as to what you did on that day?
Yeah.
Wiley is being separately prosecuted on charges she lied to the police. In this case, the defense told jurors not to trust her because she has admitted to being a liar. The defense wants to know if she's simply telling prosecutors what they want to hear in return for a deal.
I'm not guilty, but I know I lied in the beginning.
Okay. You're charged with lying to law enforcement?
Correct.
And you know you lied to law enforcement?
Yes, I did.
But you're not guilty?
I'm guilty of lying, yes.
Okay. Your hope is that when all this is said and done, that that case will be dismissed?
Yes, they understand me, yes.
Is that the understanding?
Yes. Okay.
You've been told that once this is all said and done,
you're guilty? No, I have not been told that.
Okay, so how
But my hope is that this, on my behalf, that they see me through.
Okay, well, you just said that is the understanding. What does that mean?
My understanding that I hope that my case do be dropped.
Okay. Has anyone told you that it's likely to be dropped?
No.
On May 16th, when you spoke with law enforcement, you told a story to law enforcement, and that, in fact, was a lie.
I continue to lie, yes.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. In fact, two different law enforcement officers, the evening hours of May 16th, you told a lie.
Yes.
Okay. And you did this despite the fact that a young girl who you referred to as your godchild was missing.
Correct.
Okay, because you felt it was in your best interest at that time to lie, right?
Yes.
The problem for the defense is that Ebony Wiley's grandfather corroborated her final story that she went to him to get marijuana for the defendant and that when she returned, the victim was gone. Let's jump in with the panel now. Eklund Mercy and Roger Foley back once again. So, Roger, what do you make of this? This is a death penalty case. Do you think prosecutors have enough here?
I think they have a lot of information. Although she lied in the beginning, it's almost like a witness that's been wildered down by the police that she wasn't honest in the beginning, but now she finally broke and she told the truth. And that happens in a lot of investigations. So I think there is a lot of reliability in her testimony, although I see what the defense is doing, and I think it's a good argument for them to make.
Eklund Mercy in Atlanta, Georgia, your thoughts on this. Is that key witness finally telling the truth? If so, why?
I don't know, but the defense is doing an excellent job of discrediting her testimony. When you're at the third story, and you're actually on the stand stating that you hope that when this is all done, you won't have a charge against you, that is not helpful. That is not helpful to the state's case with regards to the statement. Now, we do have cooperation for the third story, but the fact that we have three stories is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, look, especially after that witness was asked on direct by the state, hey, look, you've not been promised anything. No, okay, that's the story the state wanted, and she almost slipped up there and said, oh, I think my case is going to be dismissed. Appreciate both of your opinions here. Let's move into the panel here in New York, Linda Kenny-Bodden, Bob Hillis. So, Bob, let's talk about the charges here. We have enhanced charges in Florida, you were saying in the break to me, because of the sex crime that's alleged on top of the alleged murder here.
Yes, we have a minor, and then we have a sexual assault on that minor, and that's the basis for the request for the death penalty here.
So a lot going on legally behind the scenes here. Linda, what do you make of this? You've got drugs fueling this alleged murder, which then you've got this cover-up with the suitcase, and then the victim being thrown in the water here. I guess it all revolves around that question, do we trust Ebony Wiley? Do we trust that witness?
No, I think we also trust the fact that he was the last male to be with her, the last one to see her. Ebony went at least to look for her at CVS, didn't find her, and that this was a sexual assault, and he had sand in his car where he had dumped the body in the waterway. I think this is a no-brainer for the jury.
Okay, Bob, we're hearing, you know, I agree with Linda on this one. We're starting to agree on a lot.
I know, it's scary.
You know, but Bob, when you have that witness who's gone to look for the victim, the defense for Granville Ritchie can't turn around and try to blame her because she tried to sort of mitigate things.
And again, I think Linda hit it, you know, right on the head that he's the last one really to be tied credibly to this child.
And I think that's the key point that this particular witness makes. Appreciate both of your opinions. Linda,
thank
Bob,
you.
It's all the time we have here on The Debrief. A reminder that our live coverage of all of these cases picks up in the morning, including closing arguments in the South Carolina case of Sidney Moore that we've been watching for about a week. We'll be back on The Debrief at 5 o'clock. See you then, everybody.